Well, congratulations, Dr. Tony Wheeler. Thanks for joining us today. Congratulations on your new honorary Doctor of Letters that's being jointly awarded by the University of Warwick and our partner Monash University in Australia. The New York Times once described you as the trailblazing patron saint of the world's backpackers and adventure travellers. As an owner of several Lonely Planet guides, I'm inclined to agree. Is that how you saw yourself when you first hit the road?
Not as a patron saint at all, no. When we did that very first Lonely Planet guide, it was very much answering the sort of questions that we as young travellers were asking. And my wife and I were both in our 20s. And the information that's so readily available today, whether it's in guidebooks like Lonely Planet or on the internet or on your phone, all that stuff just wasn't available then. So we were filling a real need. But we didn't realize that it was going to fill that need so well and that people were going to appreciate it as much as they did. So I certainly wasn't a patron saint at first, but later on I began to think, well, I'm not doing a bad job here. I am helping people to do things they might not have done otherwise, and sometimes just making things a little bit easier for them. You know, opening the doors and saying, that way to a hotel and that way you'll get mugged.
Do you have a favourite place that you've travelled to, and why is it your favourite?
I sometimes say that my favourite place is the departure lounge at the airport, because then you know you're on your way to somewhere, although of course it's better to get there on foot or by some other more interesting means of travel. But if there's a country that I've been back to more than just about any other, and it's a country that really needs visitors to go back to at the moment, it's Nepal. And I fell in love with it the first time I went there, and it was probably a little bit more magical back then than it is today or before the earthquake. But Kathmandu was magic that first time I went there, and I've been back many times. And a large part of that is if there's a place in the world that is great for walking, it's Nepal. And over the years, I've walked up to the Everest base camp. I've walked around the Annapurna Mountains. I've walked up to Tibet. I've walked all over the place. So I spent a lot of months in Nepal, and I've walked a lot of miles in Nepal. So in some ways, that's been a favourite destination.
What was it like studying engineering at Warwick? Can you remember that, those times? And have you got any special memories from your time here?
Yeah, to some extent, Warwick was a little bit of an accident for me, because I'd finished school thinking I was going to do maths. And really, if I look back at school, my favourite subject wasn't anything in science at all. I enjoyed history more than anything else, but I thought, what am I going to do with history? I'm not going to, you meet people who do all sorts of things with history, of course, but I thought, you know, a science subject was better. And I turned out that maths, fortunately, wasn't going to be my calling. So engineering was the next thing. And I've always been fascinated by engineering. I still am fascinated by engineering all these years later. And Warwick, you know, it was a new university, and that was certainly part of the attraction. In fact, it was a very new university since we were the very first students there. And, of course, it was right in the industrial engineering centre of the UK. So that was a plus point as well.
Fantastic. Thanks. How did you go from your studies and travels to then turning the idea of Lonely Planet into a business that it's grown to today?
Well, the idea at first, it was very much a sort of a sideline. The time we did the first Lonely Planet guide, we did it in the evenings and the weekends sort of thing. It wasn't a full-time job at first. But we could instantly see that people, what we were doing with that first Lonely Planet guide, people liked it, they appreciated it, they wanted more of it. And we thought, well, let's do another one. And I think in many ways, when we first started the business, it wasn't like your modern dot-com business or your Facebooks and Twitters and things, which they start today and they're capitalized at $1 billion the week after. You know, Lonely Planet was very much more like the snowball rolling downhill, that it takes a while to get it turning and then it starts to go faster and gets bigger and before you know it, it's running away from you. But it wasn't an instant success at all. It was a slow burning success. But it was one of those things that, you know, as soon as we started doing it, I loved doing it. And, you know, I really blame a lot of that. The best thing I did at Warwick University was nothing to do with my engineering course at all. It was working on the university newspaper. You know, university newspapers that are very often an introduction to media and publishing and journalism to lots of people. And it's like many other things at university. You come to university expecting to learn this, and you learn something else.
I can empathise with that. And did you have a mentor or a vision when you first set up Lonely Planet? And can you tell us who or what the vision was?
Do you know, I really didn't have a mentor. I can't think of anybody who really, I followed, because really in some ways we were sort of a little bit pioneering and there wasn't anybody to really follow. But what I do remember very clearly about those early days, because it was a struggle for quite a while, was university friends who said, you know, it's going to work. I mean, and I always joked, you know, that there I was. They were driving their second BMW, or if they were in Coventry, their second Jaguar company car. And I'm rocking around in this rotten old rusty Ford Cortina, because it was the best I could afford at the time, because all the money was going into doing another book. But these friends, you know, could see that what I was doing had potential and possibilities. And, anytime I was sort of thinking, oh, this isn't going to work, why am I doing this? Maybe it's time to quit and get a real job. They'd say, no, push on. You know, what you're doing is interesting. Keep going.
You've moved on to other things, and you've set up the Planet Wheeler Foundation, which funds over 50 projects in the developing world. What was the motivation behind setting that up?
Well, really, it existed before we sold Lonely Planet. That we had a Lonely Planet Foundation for many years, and that really was triggered by the famine in Ethiopia, which is, you know, Live Aid and all those things. As I was driving here, I heard something on the radio about 30 years ago, the Live Aid concert. We were sitting talking about it at the office one day, and we were saying, look, there's this terrible disaster going on in Africa right now, and we sell lots of guides to Africa. You know, Africa is a big market for us. We're essentially making a lot of money out of tourists going to Africa. Let's put something back in. So we started a policy that a percentage of our profits went to charitable things, I could say, things that were connected in some way with the countries that we were covering. And that just grew and grew as the company got bigger. It became more and more money. And you know, it got to the stage we had a permanent employee within the business just to look after the money we gave away. And then when we sold the business, we obviously couldn't sell the business and say, oh, by the way, you bought a charitable foundation as well. So we pulled it out of Lonely Planet and we reconstituted it as Planet Wheeler. And quite a lot of the money that we got from selling Lonely Planet, we put back into Planet Wheeler. And it does much the same sort of things that it would have done within Lonely Planet, which is really the developing world, because that's where Lonely Planet started. And it's education and health, because those are really important things in the developing world. But then I've got other interests as well. And so we do some things that are arts, because my wife and I, Maureen and I, both like theatre, and she loves opera. So there's art connections. I'm on the board of an archaeology organization. Archaeology needs tourists. So, you know, I've got a footprint in that as well. So quite a lot of things that we do, which are either through Planet Wheeler or ourselves.
And thinking about the arts, you're also working on another book called Darklands. What inspired you to write that?
Well, Darklands has actually been out for a year or so now. I did a book called Badlands, and the idea of it was George Bush saying there's an axis of evil, and as any good traveller would, my first thought was, oh, an axis of evil, I'd like to see that. So I travelled around his axis of evil countries, and I found it extraordinarily interesting, and I wrote a book about those places and some other assorted bad countries. There's no shortage of bad countries. And a couple of years later, I thought, let's do a follow-up to that. So I wrote Darklands, which was dark countries. And the darkest of the lot, I guess, in that would be the Congo, Belgium. What used to be the Belgian Congo, and then it became Zaire, and that now it's the Democratic Republic of Congo, which, of course, means it isn't democratic. But, you know, it was a fascinating country to visit, and very, very few tourists go there for very good reasons. But nevertheless, I found it really interesting, and that the other countries that I featured in Darklands all had a dark side or a shadowy side to some extent, and they were all very interesting to write about.
What led you to become director of the Global Heritage Fund?
Global Heritage Fund, it's California-based, so it's actually Silicon Valley-based, so it was Silicon Valley money that kicked it off. And their feeling, it's an archaeology organisation, But archaeology does need tourists, that you can dig the thing up and somebody gets a PhD for their studies on this archaeology site. But unless you then have visitors going to it, you might as well bury it again. But if you get the local community involved and they're putting on the tours, they're driving the tour buses, they're running the cafes and taking the tickets, selling the postcards, running the guest houses and so on, they've then got a real interest in that archaeology site. They don't want people coming in and stealing things or vandalising things. So the archaeology from Global Heritage's point of view is a two-sided thing, that it's a straightforward archaeology as we think of it in the sort of academic sense, but also it's a tourist and development thing. So I love going to these sites, and when I do go there, I generally get shown around by the archaeologist who really knows about it, so that's fantastic. But my role with Global Heritage is looking at it from the tourism potential side.
That's great. And as an experienced traveller, what made you choose to settle in Melbourne, Australia?
You know, living in Melbourne, Australia is a complete chance. It was Maureen and I, when we went out to Australia, first of all, we travelled the hippie trail, as it was known in the 70s, and that led to the first Lonely Planet guidebook. And we arrived there thinking, oh, we'll have 3 months here, and then we'll have saved up enough money to get back to the UK. And we liked it so much that we ended up spending a year there. And we lived in Sydney, and then we left again thinking that we were going on our way back to England. And after a year, we'd only got from Sydney to Singapore. And we thought, oh, let's go back and have another year in Australia. And we thought, oh, we've had a year in Sydney, let's have a year in Melbourne. And we've been in Melbourne ever since. So it wasn't a conscious, a little bit like coming to Warwick, it wasn't a really conscious decision. It turned out to be a very good decision, but it was very much an accident. And the nice thing about it is that we've been there a long time, and we weren't part of Melbourne to start with. I've often said in Melbourne that if you haven't got a football team to support, you're never going to be a real Melburnian. And I'm afraid I'm not a great Australian rules football fan, so I'm afraid that Melbourne is never going to be really part of my bloodstream. But nevertheless, we've had an influence on Melbourne. We've done things for Melbourne, and I think, you know, we love Melbourne and Melbourne loves us, which is very nice.
Finally, have you got any advice for fellow graduates from the University of Warwick?
I think the advice I give to anybody setting out to, you know, start their working life, to do things, is to do what you believe in, to do something that you get a kick out of, that you find interesting. And I think everything else just follows on from that. That if you're enjoying yourself, you know, whether the thing has business prospects or is making lots of money or whatever, is really irrelevant, because you're enjoying yourself every day. And that's infectious. You know, if you're enjoying what you're doing, other people get off on what you're doing. You know, they appreciate that you're enjoying it. You're going to do better because of that. If you're selling something, as we were, you know, we loved doing Lonely Planet. We were just in love with the books. And I think that came over, that people could see that we were in love with those books. And as a result, they love them as well. So do what you believe in. Make sure that you get a job that you like.
Dr. Tony Wheeler, thank you very much.
Thank you.